This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In Texas, where we've seen a steady expansion of gun rights for nearly 25 years, Texas lawmakers are actively considering measures that would make it easier to keep firearms away from people showing signs of being dangerous. It's called a red flag law. But while any measure aimed at further regulating firearms could face a steep and political treacherous climb in gun-friendly Texas, the deadly mass shootings in Sutherland Springs and at Santa Fe High School have made it clear that something needs to change. Even people who are considered strong Second Amendment advocates who find the Second Amendment sacred are saying something needs to change. So do you think that the red flag law is needed? Do you think it'll save lives? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon by Representative Joe Moody. He's a Democrat from the District 78 in El Paso. Noel Candelaria is a president of the Texas State Teachers Association. And Greg Hance is a public policy director for the National Alliance on Mental Health. Thanks for all of y'all for joining us today as we have this conversation. And again, the number to call in, 210-614-8980. Representative Moody, can you tell me more about how this red flag law could become?
So this is a conversation that we started last session with the bill that we introduced, and the senator from El Paso also carried on the Senate side. So it operates very much like a protective order. Someone has enough of an issue that someone may be acting dangerously, and because of their conduct, because of what they're doing, and their ready access to firearms may be a danger. And so it acts like a protective order in that you have an ex parte order that's entered immediately, and then you have a full blown hearing on whether this person can be kind of separated from their weapons for a certain amount of time, and then plenty of due process included in there, as well as some safety measures so people don't use these things frivolously. And so there's some punishment mechanisms as well for someone who would use this as some sort of harassment tool. We don't want it to be weaponized. We want it to be helpful and fruitful. And so I actually came to this issue by working on suicide prevention. You know, I know that a lot of the conversation has been around school shootings and mass shootings, but where this type of law has been very impactful in other states is reducing the number of gun-related suicides.
So you're saying that there is a judge who's involved who would be someone who would be able to make sure that this is appropriate and needed?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, a judge is involved in every step of this process.
All right, so Noel Candelaria, president of the Texas State Teachers Association, what are y'all's thoughts about a red flag law?
I mean, I think that's one step in a multitude of things that need to be done. I mean, we've been talking about taking meaningful action on gun violence prevention, and I think the red flag law is one of those steps, I think one of many. There's still a lot more that we need to do in Texas regarding, you know, background checks, you know, regardless of where the purchase happens. But our focus has really been on not just, you know, how do we take meaningful action on gun violence, but also, you know, how do we ensure we're providing a safe and secure learning environment for all students, you know, including professional development on mental health, you know, behavioral health, you know, actual classroom management, safety, bully-free. How do we ensure that we're increasing access to mental health services, not just in the classroom, but in the community? So, and we see this as one positive step forward, but, you know, a small piece, I think, of a much bigger picture of what we need to do in the state of Texas to truly, truly identify the key issues to addressing school safety and gun violence prevention in our schools across the state.
Greg Hance, you're the public policy director for the National Alliance on Mental Health Texas. Some people say that any mental health indication that people have would be used as an excuse to keep them from having access to the firearms that they're guaranteed to have access to by the Second Amendment.
You know, we would push back on restricting access to firearms for all people with mental illness. You know, we would have a concern that if that were done, that would stigmatize these individuals. It would make them less likely to seek out treatment. And it would really be counterproductive to a lot of the good things that our state has done on mental health reform and increasing access to services. So while we have been supportive of these gun violence restraining orders under certain conditions. We think it's very important that they don't specifically target individuals with mental illness, but rather these orders should be based upon the actual level of dangerousness or the risk of violence, regardless or irrespective of the reason why a person is violent or a person is dangerous. You know, untreated mental illness can be one of those reasons, but there are a variety of other factors that can lead to, you know, a person being dangerous, being violent, and by having access to a firearm that, you know, increases the risk of severe harm. So we need to look at some of those other factors in addition to mental health, those other factors being things like history of violence, history of abuse of substances, various other components that need to be considered when we're thinking about who would be eligible for this temporary restriction on access to firearms.
So we call this a red flag law. And a red flag, I mean, you know a red flag when you see it. It's a flag and it's red. But when we're talking about issues of human behavior, that's not so easy to identify. I mean, it's easy in hindsight after a shooting, and we look back and say, wow, that guy really had some problems. But when we try to say, look at the general population, and some people act one way and other people act another, how do we are to say that's a red flag, Greg?
Well, you know, I think, you know, some of those factors that should be looked at to determine whether or not, you know, certain behavior is a red flag are, you know, if a person is making threats, or if a person is behaving dangerously, if they've engaged in violence or they've threatened violence, either towards themselves or others, that is an issue under this framework that could be raised in court, that the judge could be made aware of. So, you know, we're looking at verbal threats, behaviors, suicide attempts, and I think, you know, suicide needs to be a huge part of this conversation. This is not, this law would not just be about, you know, preventing interpersonal violence or mass shootings, but actually, you know, preventing suicides, knowing that the majority of gun deaths are suicides. So those are the kind of behaviors or, you know, verbal expressions that should be considered when determining, you know, whether or not something constitutes what we would consider a red flag.
We're talking about red flag laws here this afternoon on The Source. What would be considered a red flag? Is this something that you think law enforcement would be able to use fairly and predictably, or is this something that's going to be that could be used against individuals that they don't like? We'll talk more about that when we come back from this break. Our phone line is 210-614-8980. Can a red flag law save lives, particularly as we look at some of the mass shootings that we've seen around us here in Texas, like at Santa Fe or in Sutherland Springs? These shootings, sometimes they don't have those red flags, but is a measure of somewhat that's going to help a little bit, is that more than nothing? So call in, tell us what you think. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Governor Greg Abbott's plan to curb school shootings has embraced an idea championed by El Paso Democrat State Representative Joe Moody. It's an idea that's called a red flag law. It's also gaining bipartisan support. People are thinking that this could be a way to save lives. We're talking about this law this afternoon. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. Joseph has called in. Joseph, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, I just wanted to say that that red flag law, that sounds good, but there are so many levels of gray between a person actually taking action and maybe a person that just is more likely to vent his feelings publicly. So this law is just not a good law because of all the gray areas between being truly a person who shouldn't have a gun and somebody who is just maybe depressed, maybe made his comments about Trump or somebody publicly, is that a person that should be involved with this red flag law?
All right, Joseph, thank you for that call. Let's go to Representative Joe Moody from El Paso and get your response.
Sure. So we're talking about dangerous behavior, you know, dangerous behavior that's exhibited by this individual that's tied to their access to firearms, so that they pose an immediate and present danger of causing injury to someone else or themselves. And, I know, you know, to Greg's point, I think suicide prevention is really a large part of this conversation that that we need to make sure continues. We do have a lot of folks that are highlighting school shootings and mass shootings, and that is certainly something that this could help prevent in certain circumstances. But suicide prevention is really, you know, where a law like this can have the broadest impact, because this is a different mechanism, a different tool. Because today, you can deprive someone of access to weapons when you have a family violence protective order, let's say. Or you can deprive the person of access to firearms if you go through an involuntary mental health commitment, right? So you're actually taking the person into custody and putting them, you know, separating them. And so that's a very invasive and serious process. This is a process in the middle, and addresses, to Greg's point, addresses the fact that this doesn't necessarily mean that anyone that has a mental health issue is prone to violence. In fact, we need to be very careful in this conversation to not point in that direction. You know, I've been proud to work on mental health issues and help to raise awareness about mental illness and to start to end the stigma around mental illness. We could take a lot of dangerous steps backwards if we equate these situations to only individuals that have mental illness or have mental health issues. So we need to be careful in that conversation. That may be a component, there may be a nexus, but that's not everything in it that we have here. So we're talking about dangerous behavior. People are worried about their family members. They're worried about their loved one doing something to themselves or someone else. And using a court process to help them. That's short of arresting someone, because there are certainly things that people can do that rise to the level of a criminal offense. But do you really want to, some family members, do you really want to call law enforcement to arrest your loved one? Maybe this is a step that we can do that's different, that solves that problem, that it erases that dangerous situation for a period of time that maybe we can stabilize and move forward.
I'm going to play a clip here. This is from a UT student, UT Austin, Selena Rashashi, and she was at a town hall on Monday with the Parkland shooting survivors. Let's play that.
First of all, in our great state of Texas, about 2/3 of firearm-related deaths are suicide by a firearm. Yeah, got real quiet. It's kind of really, you know, one of those things that never makes headlines, in part because you want to respect the family that and the community that has lost that person. But at the same time, it makes up a large portion of these firearm deaths. It makes up a large portion of gun violence. And a lot of people come up to me and they ask me, like, why not just talk about mental health? Like, they would just, you know, the person who you lost, the person who people lose, would go on to commit suicide in other ways. Well, suicide by firearm is about 80% fatal. Other methods of suicide don't even reach like half that fatality rate. Suicide is often an impulsive decision. Most of the times, within the 24 hours that you decide that you feel like committing suicide, you actually go on and attempt it. It's not something that's thought through as much. That's why things such as waiting periods have been shown to reduce the suicide by firearm rate. And in essence, the reason why suicide by firearm is super important is because it is the most fatal, like this is literally, we're handing over this weapon that you can use to pretty much 100% like take your life to people who, you know, are in a position where they might hurt themselves or others, and it's completely 100% preventable. One thing that we talk about here in Texas a lot and that we're pushing for are red flag laws. Y'all know what that is?
Yes.
Yeah? Red flag laws basically meant that if I, you know, knew that my friend, which I kind of did, know that she had access to a firearm, I also knew that she was struggling with her mental health, I could have, in essence, flagged her. She would have gone through a due process, and I could have made it so that she maybe could have lived another day.
So Greg Hance, Public Policy Director for the National Alliance on Mental Health Texas, when you hear Selena talk about her friend and the element of firearms with suicide, what's your reaction?
Well, I guess my reaction would be, you know, I could not have said it better myself than what we just heard that student say. You know, suicide attempts with a firearm rarely offer a second chance. They are almost always completed. If a person doesn't have access to a firearm, but is in crisis, which, you know, we can say to mean basically they're suicidal, if they don't have access to a firearm, they're much more likely to survive that initial suicide attempt. So if we can sort of limit access on the front end, we can get people kind of over that hump. And by the way, most people who attempt suicide and who do survive, so those are a lot of people who didn't have access to firearm, do not go on to die by suicide. That's 90% of those folks who attempt and survive do not go on to die. So that's an amazing statistic right there. And it doesn't get talked about enough. And in fact, there's a lot of, you know, misconceptions about the nature of being suicidal, where it gets said over and over again, you know, if a person wants to die, if a person wants to end their own life, they'll find a way to do that. But that's not the reality. One, if we can stop the initial attempt from being successful, we then have a multitude of options to get that person help, to get that person into treatment. And, you know, treatment works, and treatment is getting better and better every day, where most people who get access to treatment who have a mental illness do recover and do experience a higher quality of life and do go on to thrive. So it's really about access to treatment and sort of funneling people in that direction. But in order to do that, the person has to be alive. They have to survive the initial attempt. When people are in crisis, there's really one thing to do, whether you're the individual or whether you're a family member or a friend. If a person is an active risk of harm to themselves, you have got to call 911 and make clear that that person is experiencing a mental health crisis. And there are different crisis responses out there. It can be through law enforcement. It can be through the mental health system. But we have to get that person access to care as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, we can't get them access to care if their initial suicide attempt is successful. And that's why we have to restrict access for this particular narrow segment of the population on the front end as early as possible.
Back to the phone calls. This is Amy. Amy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling because I'm a mental health therapist in San Antonio, and I have a few points to make that I think are in favor of keeping this red flag law outside of the court system. So in my mind, it would work really well if this were modeled like CPS, in which people who suspect others of possibly being dangerous, but they're not certain enough to call 911, can make that phone call, provide their evidence, and then pass it off to an agency who further investigates and looks for evidence to support that. You might be able to catch people earlier in the process if that were the way that this were designed. The CPS model also includes a lot of education for people who've been suspected but maybe haven't committed a crime against their child, but supports better implementation or management of their firearm and educating the person about mental health. And also I want to say that another reason to keep it out of the courts is that we currently are not very good at executing the emergency detainer rules in Texas, at least in Bexar County. As a mental health therapist, I was just last night involved in a case where it was 5 hours from beginning to end, my suspicion or concern about an individual being unsafe to themselves before a determination was made at the hospital about admitting or not. And that's not acceptable because people have time to calm down. They collect themselves and present a different story when they have that kind of time. They're not presenting like the dangerous person that was initiating the whole call.
Amy, thank you so much for the call. Let me go back to Representative Joe Moody to talk about her suggestions. Obviously, the bill that you're proposing does have a judge involved, a court system involved, and that is seen as an important safeguard. But people who are opposed to this bill and these type of red flag laws, they're concerned about the slippage, that once they adopt this, then soon these other elements that you call safeguards are going to be removed, and they say that's why they oppose these things.
Yeah, I mean, the opposition that we heard at the hearing a few weeks back was pretty divorced from the reality of what this legislation does. But at any rate, I actually think the caller brings up a couple of good issues. One is our current commitment process, our current mental health commitment and involuntary commitment process is problematic. And part of what the governor gave us was a task not just to look at lethal violence protective orders or these red flag laws, but also said, look at our current constructs today, and are we doing them well? And I think she just raised the issue that at a local level in San Antonio, something is wrong with the way they operate that system now. So, and it's not just San Antonio. This is something we heard from witnesses across the state. So that's something we certainly need to look at, is improving the processes that we have in place today, and that's part of our task. The court structure is going to be essential. If the goal is to remove weapons from someone or remove their access to weapons, that is a right that you need to have sufficient due process in place to be able to deprive someone of. So you necessarily are going to have to involve a process like this. You're ultimately going to have to go to the court system. And, you know, CPS as an agency certainly can investigate things, but ultimately they will percolate to the court system as well if you're going to have a removal proceeding or anything like that. So necessarily, there's a court infrastructure that has to be a part of this, and I think that's going to be where a lot of the debate lies on this issue, is what does that process look like? Is it one that is protective of rights and freedoms, but also is balanced in a way that we can address some of these serious situations?
Noel Candelaria, president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Teachers are going to be one of those individuals who are going to be able to flag a student who may exhibit behavior that needs to be identified and be brought into this. Will teachers be trained for that?
Well, and I think that's been a fundamental need across the state of Texas, with the lack of resources to provide the adequate training for all teachers, and not just teachers. We also forget that there are bus drivers, there's cafeteria workers, custodians, all of the adults who interact with our students throughout an entire school day, from the moment they're picked up on the bus to the moment they're dropped off, to be able to be trained to identify the smallest of signals that often our students give us, to be able to identify and not only have the resources within our school districts to be able to direct our students and for our staff to know what resources are accessible for our students to be able to get the training that they need, or the healthcare that they need, but also what are the resources once they leave our school system? We're not only talking about what's happening within the school, how do we train, and the challenge that we have in Texas with the high teacher turnover, which this training becomes even more important, where right now we're looking at one out of every three teachers in the state of Texas has 5 years or less of experience.
Right.
So a lot of the training that we have as teachers, where we're over our years of experience, we're able to identify.
Okay, Noel, we'll talk more about that, how teachers are on the front line of trying to prevent these types of mass shootings, particularly in schools. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. As we talk about red flag laws, how they would work, and will they save lives? The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Red flag laws, is this a way to make Texas safer, especially we're in this age of mass shootings? The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Julie is on the line. Julie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to bring up the issue of background checks. I feel like, and this is related because the governor and the state of Texas are supposedly considering, you know, ways to reduce gun violence. There exists a loophole, giant loophole, in the state of Texas and many other states, that when our legislators, and I've called them all, state and federal, plus the governor and the lieutenant governor, they refuse to recognize it, and they refuse to address these loopholes, and by doing that, they protect the rights of felons to access guns.
Let's go to Representative Joe Moody from El Paso, District 78. When Governor Greg Abbott released his 40-point school safety plan, you thought it was, what, not all it could be?
I think her concern is one that a lot of us share, is that there's some solutions and some ideas that have been discussed at a lot of levels, and they somehow were not included in that plan to even discuss, to even have a conversation about them. And to Noelle's point, there's a lot on the education front that pushes down to the school level without a lot of answers as to how we're going to fund them. And, you know, we ask our teachers to do a lot in the classroom, a lot. And if we're going to have them engage at this level, you know, how are we going to make sure that they have the tools that they need? Teachers want to help their kids. That's ultimately why they're in the profession. It's a vocation to that end. And if all we do is push them more mandates and don't give them the support they need, then we're really setting them up to fail. And we shouldn't be about that, especially when it comes to the safety and security of our children. So, you know, to her point, there are some massive misses in this plan. You know, and there are certainly some conversations that we need to flesh out more so that when we put things out there and we hand down mandates, that we're actually doing them in a way that is productive and we actually can accomplish the goals that we set out to do.
So we have this philosophy or this law saying that we can have person-to-person sales of guns without universal background checks or any sort of background checks at all right now. So if a person is given a red flag and they come and they take their guns, that person could hop in their car and go to the nearest gun show and basically buy another gun, Representative Moody, right?
So those are the gaps. You know, those are certainly the gaps that we would want to address, right? That the plan doesn't really address those gaps. And so for those of us in the legislature that are trying to find broad ways to address this issue, we need to think about those gaps as well. Whether they're in the plan or not, we need to be envisioning what that system would look like, because it certainly would be something that would cause me great concern. And so you know, this is not an issue that's going to be resolved with one bill or one initiative, or with a security system at one school in one county. It's something that's going to take a broad-based approach to address. And it's in a state like ours, that conversation is going to be very difficult to have.
Let's go to another caller. This is Merle. And Merle, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. So hypothetically, I think it could be a good idea, the red flag law. However, the court process generally takes quite a bit of time to be initiated and finalized, and I think that people that had planned to do something dangerous could get a gun and carry out these acts in that meantime before the court is even able to finalize anything.
Okay, Merle, thank you for that. Let's go back to Representative Joe Moody, because this is addressing the core parts of your proposed law.
Mm-hmm. So, like other protective orders, there is an emergency piece to the process, in which, I mean, in reality, you would have the county attorney present this case on behalf of whether it's a law enforcement or an individual family member, that they would take this directly to the court and they would issue a temporary order for 14 days. And so that order is immediate. It is done ex parte. That's part of the conversation we're having about due process and whether that's sufficient. Due process. I think it is necessary to have the immediacy because of what the caller said. If you're talking about a person who is dangerous and is exhibiting behavior that is dangerous and is a serious risk to themselves or others, you don't want to give them notice and say, hey, why don't you come down to the courthouse in 2 weeks and let's talk about your dangerous behavior. No, it's something that there is an immediacy that you need to have to it, and that's why the ex parte process needs to be in place. And so what it does say is within 14 days of that initial order being signed, we will have a court hearing. Because we're talking about a constitutional right here, we want to make sure that there's a full-blown hearing and that there's an opportunity for all sides to be heard. And then the judge would make a determination whether to extend that order on, we call it a permanent protective order, but it doesn't mean permanent in time. It means for a year. And then there are mechanisms in the bill to, you know, to cut that short if the need arises, or if there's evidence that it should be cut short. And then there's also ways to extend it if the need is also there. So the immediate piece is in the structure, and also the way to continue to protect people over time. So it is a delicate balance, and it's one, I think, that, like I said before, I think this is where the debate will lie, is what this process looks like.
Let's go back to Noel Candelaria, president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Before the break, we were talking about how teachers are on the front line. They have to deal with students. They see, everyone's watching these mass shootings on television, sometimes not on television, in your own classroom. How are they coping with this, particularly when they're being asked to be the first screener of students who could be dealing with this mental health issues? English teachers, they get papers written from these students, and they will tell them right there that they're having dangerous thoughts.
I mean, I think it also speaks to the shortage of counselors and the counselors we have in our schools, who are doing everything except actually counseling. And I think that's a challenge that, especially at the high school level, where teachers often, the first person they turn to is the high school counselor. And when the high school counselor is overburdened with being the one that's the testing coordinator on their campus, and they've got, you know, a multitude of other things that has nothing to do with counseling, I think it provides a really big challenge when not only are we asking our teachers to be looking out, to identify, you know, what are some of the signs, to then call and ask for help, but then we turn to the counselors, and our counselors are overworked and overburdened. And the fact that, you know, we just have a shortage of mental health professionals, even within our own school system and a lot of communities. And so it does provide a really big challenge when, we don't have the training on how to be able to deal with it immediately as it's happening in our classroom, and then being able to have the resources to access within the school, or even within the school district, oftentimes even within the community, which does provide a huge challenge when we're talking about, a state as big as Texas, as diverse as Texas, with almost about 1,200 school districts, and the various needs that every one of those communities has across the state of Texas. I mean, how do we systemically ensure that we are not only able to provide the resources, but the adequate training to all of the professionals who are interacting with, you know, our 5.4 million students across the entire state of Texas?
Okay, and Ray is on the line. Ray, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes, sir, I was considering, I believe that 90-95% of the school shooter problem will cease once the San Antonio Police Department substations, school district police stations, are embedded, implanted, or the whole office is moved to the inside the schools, the elementary, the middle, and the high school. Spread them out where I live at, where I'm at. I pass by my police substation, and, man, there's got to be, I don't know, 100 police officers that come and go there all day, and they're, you know, getting their paperwork. There's plenty of cop cars on the parking lot. And so I figure, you know what, just take that whole office and put them inside the school. Spread them out evenly. And there will be activity there all the time.
All right, Ray, thank you for that point. So, Noel, you're with the Texas State Teachers Association. Would that be a solution?
I mean, not every community has a police department, you know, and so you look at rural Texas, the nearest police department sometimes is 20, 30 minutes away when you're looking at a sheriff's department or sheriff's deputy to be able to respond. And at the end of the day, we want our schools to be a place that is about learning, and students, you know, don't feel like they're walking into a prison or feeling like, you know, and it just perpetuates the whole school to prison pipeline. And, you know, we don't want our schools to be police states, and we want our schools to be able to harness the creativity of learning and not just have constant presence of a police and feel like you're sitting in the county jail. And I think that that's kind of counterproductive to the purpose of our schools. And so, but what we are calling that is needed is to ensure that, you know, for that safety, is how do we coordinate resources between the county, the city, and the school district that have their own police departments or not, to ensure that there's adequate resources to provide, professionals who are trained as peace officers to help be on campus, you know, where there's, you know, where we have that resource on the campus, but not be the central point of a campus. I mean, you know, putting a campus in, using a campus as a substation, I think is not the solution. But how do we ensure that we have, that our school districts have the resources to have those professionals, you know, relatively close to the campuses, you know, as needed, and also that they receive the training. You know, that's the other thing. I mean, I worked at a campus where we were the adjudicated campus, an alternative campus for discipline. We had police officers on our campus, but we had to make sure they were trained on how to be, you know, school resource officers and how to be able to interact with students and with children. That specialized training that you don't necessarily receive automatically as a police officer unless you're going to be, you know, trained to work with kids. And so, you know, that training is also very specialized in being a trained peace officer, but also being able to be trained to work and interact with students and not react the way you would out on the street, but how do you react in situations with students, especially students that may be in crisis.
All right, Noel. So what to do about the mass shootings that we have seen here in Texas and across the country? Would a red flag law make these shootings more rare and less deadly? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. When there is a case of domestic violence, sometimes a judge can tell they're going to take someone's guns. They say, you can't have your guns anymore. You are clearly a danger. What about in other cases where a person is showing signs of mental instability and as it could be a harm to themselves or others? Should judges have that ability to take guns away from those individuals? Give us a call as we talk about a red flag law. The number is 210-614-8980. So Representative Joe Moody, we've been talking about in classrooms and how this is something the area of concern. How would this deal with minors who have access to their parents' guns? Can you tell a parent you can't have access to your guns because you have a minor who's exhibiting dangerous behavior?
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the issues that we're going to have to tackle in having this conversation. Because if you see, you know, you've certainly seen examples of children with access to weapons. But that was one of the other things that we discussed at the hearing was safe storage. So what do we do to encourage safe storage of weapons? And unfortunately, this week I've seen headlines, I think even out of San Antonio in other communities in which young children have accidentally shot themselves with weapons that were left out, that were not safely stored. And so what are we doing to encourage better behavior, to educate people about safe storage? We have laws in the books that certainly can hold people accountable criminally for making weapons accessible to children and something bad happening. But, you know, that's certainly one remedy we can look at. But are we incentivizing good behavior? And it's something else we can do as a government, right? Incentivize good behavior. Are we doing that? Are we using public service announcements through DPS or other agencies to promote safe storage, like we do click it or ticket, or other things that we talk about public safety, in that PSA kind of avenue? Those are all things that we can do and we should do. Unfortunately, have been missing from the broader conversation. We heard
a lot. Do we ever prosecute parents who have left weapons out and a child, a 3-year-old, kills himself with that? And we say, oh, well, the parent has suffered enough. Do we prosecute?
They can be. And there's been a couple hundred prosecutions since that law went on the books in the 90s. My guess is the majority of the prosecutions are cases in which a child accessed weapon and killed or hurt another child, not themselves. I can't say that for certain, but my guess is, you know, as a former prosecutor, if I was looking at the discretion I had when charging those offenses, I would certainly put cases in which, another child was injured. To your point, if a parent has lost a child in that way, that may be something that is a little. You know, it doesn't really, we charge them with a misdemeanor crime. I'm not sure exactly what goal you're accomplishing there. So that was my point, is we certainly have criminal liability available, and it's something we should look at and certainly a tool we should have. But what are we doing to encourage and to educate people to safe store their weapons? We're not going to be able to pass something that is a mandatory way that you store weapons. That's a political reality. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. It doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it. And I'm certainly going to be a part of that conversation. But we need to encourage people to do better, to use best practices, because stories about children getting access to weapons and killing themselves or other children are just, they're too frequent, and we can do something about that.
Let's go to another caller, Jerome. Jerome, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I just have a quick question in terms of how this would look in practicality in terms of an actual gun sale. From what I've been hearing, it sounds like everything's being done kind of like after the fact somebody gets identified with mental health. So say somebody walked in, they're at the store, say it's Dick's Academy, whatever the case may be. How would that look? Is there going to be some sort of database where somebody can look up this information saying, hey, this is a high-risk red flag kid or this is a high-risk person with mental illness? Because that's going to end up running into a lot of HIPAA laws. Or is it going to be like a subjective thing where somebody's working there and they can say, hey, you better look like you have a bad day, or hey, I'm afraid of your skin color, so you look dangerous to me, so I'm not going to sell you a gun. So I was just trying to figure out how would this actually look in terms of, hey, right there in that spot, in that moment, somebody trying to purchase a gun who could be considering with some sort of mental illness or considering suicide.
Okay. So, Jerome, there's a lot there, but let me go to Greg Hantz and ask him. He's with the Public Policy Director with the National Alliance on Mental Health Texas. How secure would this information be? Are you concerned about it leaking out and hurting this person in other areas of their life?
No. And, you know, I think there are a few things to be said here. I mean, for one, you know, let's say a judge issues an order, either a temporary order or, you know, the 14-day one, or a longer-term order, the one that could go up to a year. That information about that order and about the factors that are, you know, leading the judge to make that decision to temporarily restrict a person's access to firearms, that information would be stored in an existing system called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. And so this is a, you know, an existing framework where, let's say, there are certain factors that can lead a person already to sort of be prohibited by their name being entered into that system if there's an involuntary mental health commitment, you know. So that system is secure, you know, where there's not a concern about those individuals' information leaking out. It's managed at the Department of Public Safety. Okay. So, you know, I wouldn't worry about, you know, people and their information, you know, losing sort of privacy of their information. That's not a concern that we have. Now, as far as the discretion of, you know, gun shop owners to say, well, we don't think that this person can safely possess a firearm, they have existing discretion already.
Right. Any gun clerk can deny the sale of a gun to anyone for any kind of reason, if they do think a person. But how is that gun clerk going to know?
Exactly.
Let me go to one more caller. This is Randy. And Randy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Glad to be here. While I appreciate all of the attention and work to find out a solution to some of these issues and figure out what's going on inside the head, the prior caller just illustrated how impossible it is to always know what's going on. I'm a teacher. And I see a trend year to year that makes it more harrowing that we don't know. And as a reminder to policymakers and to listeners, as a society, we really need to step back and improve our chances that any one particular individual is not going to pull out a gun and do damage. And we do that by providing social services, making sure that the kids grow up in a well-balanced way, not having wants and needs not met.
Okay, thank you for that. So Noel Candelaria, president of the Texas State Teachers Association, can you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's talking about exactly what is the purpose of our school system, right? And it is exactly to do that. Is, I mean, how do we ensure that we are providing all of the resources the moment the child walks into our school, you know, to when they graduate, to help, you know, develop well-rounded citizens who are socially connected, which I think is a big challenge, as you know, as we go through, you know, with the advent of social media and all these barriers that are dividing us. But you know, how do we continue to talk about and focus on not only what are the resources that we need in our schools, what do we need to make sure that all the professionals in our schools, what training do they have to ensure that we're meeting the needs of the whole child, but also, you know, what happens after they leave you know, our schools. I mean, as a high school special education teacher, I can tell you that there was a huge shortfall when my students graduated, and all of a sudden their access to resources and mental health support was almost non-existent. And so we need to have a conversation about not only how do we support and build our students and ensure that, that they have, because they can experience trauma at any point in their life, even after they leave our school system. And if we don't have the infrastructure both as we're developing the young minds into adulthood and once they reach adulthood to ensure that we have all the safety nets in every community across the state of Texas, then, you know, we're going to continue to perpetuate it until we truly address the needs of not just the whole child, but the communities as a whole.
And Greg Hance with the National Alliance on Mental Health Texas, we have people who, and I've sat down and had coffee with some of these guys, and they like to put on their long guns and these Bushmasters, and they'll walk around outside and they'll protest with them, and they're locked and loaded. And someone might look at that and say, well, that's dangerous. And that person, I mean, it doesn't make any sense that they would do that, that's mental health. That's a dangerous person. We should take their guns away. Is that something that would be diagnosed as this is a dangerous person, take their gun away, or this is a person who was overtly exercising their Second Amendment right?
Yeah, no, I do not believe that that would meet the criteria for a person to be considered dangerous and, you know, therefore having their firearms rights temporarily restricted. Just walking around with a gun, you know, the practice of open carry is something that is allowed for in Texas under certain conditions. The practice of campus carry is allowed for under certain conditions. Just having a gun is not, would not be enough. Having a gun out in public would not be enough to say, well, that person is dangerous. We must temporarily restrict their firearms rights. In fact, you know, at the hearing that was had on this issue recently at the Capitol, you could see people there who are carrying firearms. But that's far from what we're talking about when we're saying, you know, a person is dangerous, a person is an imminent risk of harm to self or others. What we're talking about there are acts of violence, threat of violence, suicide threats, suicide attempts, unlawful or reckless use of weapons, but not just carrying a weapon.
So Joe Moody, representative from District 78 in Del Paso, people who post on Facebook pictures of their guns, we've used that as examples like this person was dangerous, they shouldn't have been allowed to have guns. But according to what I'm hearing, that's not going to be enough to take away their guns. I've only got about 30 seconds.
Sure. We're talking about dangerous behavior and conduct. I mean, could things like that come into play to the broader picture? Yes. Like anything in the court system, that you'd be asking the judge to look at the whole picture, right? So those are certainly pieces of the puzzle, but they certainly aren't definitive. And that's the part that I think people get concerned about, is that am I going to be infringed somehow from exhibiting my, using my First Amendment rights mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form? And that's really not the goal. The goal is to look at dangerous behavior that could be potentially turned violent and destructive.
Still a mountain to climb when the legislative session begins in January. Representative Joe Moody, thank you so much. Noel Candelaria with the Texas State Teachers Association, and Greg Hanch is the Texas Policy Director of the National Alliance for Mental Health. Thank you so much.